Yeah. Just for background purposes, I did my undergraduate at Waterloo in applied math and computer science, and did my graduate training in applied mathematics. There is use for applied mathematics in other fields and disciplines. I tried to come up with a provocative title for today's talk, so I called it The Data Tsunami in Radiation Therapy. I think at this point, we're finding that our ability to capture data has far outstripped our ability to process data. Michael made lots of promises for my talk, so I hope I can deliver on some of them. Quick overview, I'm going to give an introduction, kind of a radiotherapy 101, talk about the radiotherapy process. I'll try to touch on these kind of three optimization problems, because this is an optimization forum. Intensity-modulated radiation therapy, which I think Michael has touched on. I can skip through that quickly. Something that we're very keenly involved in at Princess Margaret Hospital is image-guided radiation therapy, so the ability to image patients just before we treat them using a technology called cone beam CT or cone beam computed tomography. Talk about image registration, another nice optimization problem, and this idea that now that we have all these images of patients on a day-to-day basis, we're starting to see things. We're starting to see things change and things respond. And so how are we going to adapt the radiation therapy to respond to these changes? And I'll try to summarize. So what is cancer? So Wikipedia, of course, is the first place that you go to, the uncontrolled division of cells. So something happens, a mutation in a cell, a cosmic ray, a genetic instability, and these cells no longer go to the normal cell cycle of apoptosis or cell death. They actually start to proliferate uncontrolled. And so the four main histologies for cancer are carcinomas, which is basically like skin cells or epithelial cells. And this is the forms of breast, prostate, lung, and colon cancer, the big kind of cancers that form in patients. Sarcomas is a cancer of connective tissue or muscles. And lymphomas are cancers in lymph nodes. And leukemia is associated with blood and bone marrow. So those are basically liquid cancers. So those are the histologies that happen. So cancer occurrence, 145,000 Canadians will be diagnosed with cancer. That's one every 4 minutes. So breast and prostate are number one. There's a bit of a higher incidence in males. So if we look at the 2004 cancer stats for Canada now, we see that for females, the breast, lung, and colorectal are the big three. And for men, it's prostate, lung, and colorectal. And the good thing is that prostate and breast are actually quite treatable. They have very good survival rates and have very good control rates. But lung and colorectal are some of the ones that have very, very poor rates. And so this is kind of the focus of a lot of the thrust in research is how to kind of increase those control rates and diagnosis. So oncology treatment options, okay, basically it's not rocket science. You have a tumor there, you're going to try and take it out. So you could do that by surgery, you could do that by some kind of drugs or chemotherapy. And the one that we're interested in today is talking about radiation therapy. But of course, there's all kinds of other experimental therapies that we're looking at the Ontario Cancer Institute and Princess Margaret Hospital. These could involve gene therapy, photodynamic therapy, cryotherapy where you freeze it, radiofrequency ablation, or perhaps high-intensity focused ultrasound. So this is where you focus ultrasound waves to a particular point. Okay, so radiation therapy is the direction of high-energy x-rays to a cancerous target and trying to deposit a curative dose of radiation. The interesting stat here is that actually 50% of patients diagnosed with cancer get radiation therapy at some time during the treatment. This might be a primary treatment, or it might be a follow-up treatment or a palliative treatment. And so that's 50%. One in two patients are going to receive some kind of radiation therapy during their treatments. So who is this guy? Well, of course, that's Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen, the discoverer of X-rays, and so he discovered them in 1895. This was the Nobel Prize in Physics that he won. We were very fortunate a couple of years ago. We got to go to the University of Würzburg in Germany, and we actually got to tour his lab, and they had his Nobel Prize there under glass. So radiation for X-rays, we're kind of looking in here between the ultraviolet and the gamma. Well, the interesting thing is that he received the 1901 Nobel Prize for this, and Emil Grubet at the University of Chicago is only 1 year later where he's actually using this for treatment of patients. And so there's a little excerpt out of a manuscript here, very flowery language, so I'll kind of highlight a couple of the quotes out of here. It says, the X-ray is the most remarkable therapeutic agent of the last decade, and I think talking about 1800s. number 2 or number 12 here, the X-ray has a selective influence upon cells of the body, abnormal cells being affected more readily than normal cells. So it's even 1902, they were actually seeing these kind of respects. They didn't, these kind of effects. They didn't understand them, but they are actually observing them. So it was mostly observational at the beginning. And then the use of X-rays is without a doubt a valuable addition to the therapeutics of malignant diseases and cannot demand too much attention from the progressive physician. So kind of a very foreseeing way back then. So radiotherapy 101, what happens? So Emil Grubé didn't know anything about DNA and double strand breaks. And so what ionizing radiation is doing is it's coming in and it's trying to either cause an oxygen molecule to be ionized and then cause DNA damage, or it's trying to do direct action where it's actually trying to break these DNA strands. And the premise is that the healthy cells, after they've had this DNA strand break, can actually repair. The unhealthy cells, like the cancer cells, can't repair. So it does this kind of selective kind of repair. So it's almost kind of like a molecular agent. You do an insult to it, and then it responds. And so healthy tissues respond better than unhealthy tissues. And so here's a really zoomed-in view. This is some very interesting work done by Rob Bristow in his lab at Princess Margaret Hospital. Here's actually a human fibroblast cell. So this is the nucleus of the cell. And what they're able to do is they're actually able to stain for double strand breaks or DNA damage. And so all these little kind of green and red dots here are different fluorescent dyes that are actually picked up at the sites where DNA is being broken. So even after 3 hours after 2 gray of radiation, you can actually see the response of this radiation. So it's very, very interesting to be able to see it down on that quick and cellular level. When you're doing this in patients, you don't tend to see any kind of clinical results until long after the treatment is done, maybe a 6-month follow-up or a year follow-up. And so it's this idea that we can actually zoom back in time by looking at this kind of microscopic scale. So just some details here. Biological effects is related to the physical dose. So the more dose you give, the more biological effects you're going to see. And the physical dose is measured in gray, which is joules per kilogram in the SI measuring system. So here's what the fractionation effects. I think Michael touched on this very briefly. So if I plot dose here versus the log cell survival, so as I increase the dose, we're going to see the kind of cells kind of dying off. And so the blue is indicating the tumor here. So as I give more dose of radiation, I can see kind of these things dying off. Now, the late tissue effects is corresponding to the healthy cells. And so, of course, this is good to actually kill the tumor. This is bad to actually have these toxicities. And one of the things that they've noticed that if they can deliver it in several discrete fractions, you can actually kind of allow the healthy tissue to actually repair, and you can kind of promote the separation between those two things. So that's a therapeutic ratio that they're trying to promote. And so if I go to this next slide, what this is plotting here is the therapeutic ratio. So what I'm plotting on here is dose along the bottom. This is a percent along the top here. So red is the tumor or tumor control probability. Blue is the healthy tissue. So you can see as I give more dose, I'm going to eventually kill everything. As I give not enough dose, I'm not going to kill anything. And so it's this kind of throttling in between that you're going to try and pick your prescription at. So I want to pick my prescription to kind of have maybe a little bit of toxicity that I can tolerate, but have very good probability of actually killing the tumor. And the other thing that we want to do is we want to be able to kind of pull these curves apart. What we're trying to do is always kind of push this blue curve to the right, and we're trying to pull this red curve to the left. And so the ways we can do that are by using intensity-modulated radiation therapy to minimize the amount of healthy tissue that we deliver, or we could use something like a radiosensitizer or a drug to actually cause the tumor to be more susceptible to radiation damage. And so these are the kind of therapeutic ratio that we're always kind of throttling around. So this is the radiotherapy process. We have patient preparation. We find a CT scan and specify the volume. It goes through treatment plan. It goes through an evaluation step where it's signed off by an oncologist and a physicist, and then we go on to treatment delivery. And typically in this kind of tight loop here is that we may kind of have verification throughout that treatment delivery. And so what are the delivery process? Oh, this is going to blink. Hang on. Let's try this. There we go. Okay, trust me, there's actually a movie there. Okay, so this is showing a medical linear accelerator. This is some of the components inside. So this is a magnetron which generates radio frequency. That radio frequency resonates in this kind of cavity called the waveguide, and the electron gun is what's pushing it in. I did. Yeah, it still didn't bring this movie back, unfortunately. Okay, so there's that's what it looks like kind of in cartoon fashion. So here we can see this kind of gun, and it's kind of pulsing out these electrons. These electrons go off the cathode, which is negatively charged, to the anode, which is positively charged, and then they kind of, radio frequency wave kind of comes in the side here and kind of propagates down. And so it's a traveling wave of electrons, and these electrons kind of, of RF, and these electrons kind of travel along this wave and accelerate to very, very high energies, typically anywhere from, 10 to 25 million electron volts they actually accelerate. Just for interest here, the maximum RF power of this particular device is 7 megawatts. It runs at 3 gigahertz, which is the same as your microwave at home, so this is about 10,000 times the power of the microwave at home, so that'll pop a lot of popcorn. Okay, so as I think this is the exact same picture that Michael used. So what happens after it accelerates down the length of this waveguide is it's bent around, it's hit into a target to change the electrons into photons, and then those photons are shaped and confined using a collimator. So this is showing a multi-leaf collimator here. It has anywhere from 40 to 80 to 120 leaves. Yes, David.
What's the scale of this? How big is this thing?
So typically, these leaves are projecting to the isocenter anywhere from 4 millimeters to about a centimeter. If they open all the leaves up, that'll give a 40 by 40 centimeter field at the isocenter. So it depends on how close this is to the actual source. If it's really, really close to the source, then the leaves have to be quite small. But as you get farther away from the source, then the leaves are a little bit bigger because of the mix. Those leaves are probably about half a centimeter thick at that. And so those are all kind of on motor control and slide in and out. And so they can actually, these are quite thick because they have to attenuate these high energy electrons or photons and allow you to kind of have these kind of shapes within within the constraints of the delivery system. So this is one way to kind of modulate the beam. So typically inside this field aperture, it's a uniform beam, and that's the way the beams are defined. But suppose we want to modulate that beam. One simple way of modulating it is to actually stick a wedge in there, which is thick on one side and thin on the other, and you can put kind of a tilted field on there. Another way to do it is through intensity modulated radiation therapy, and so that will be in just a second. So this was kind of as they started kind of 30 or 40 years ago, what you did for conventional techniques is you just had square fields. And so you kind of took the size of the tumor, you kind of found the biggest square that kind of fit it, and then you would make a square field. As you get to having multi-leaf collimators, you could actually do conformal techniques. And so this is where in each view you would actually conform the radiation field to the outline of the tumor shape in that beam's eye view. So this is intensity modulated radiation therapy, and so it's very similar to what kind of goes on inside your SLR camera. As you know, as you want to expose the film, you just have two kind of apertures and you slide it across the film, and then based on the spacing of those apertures and based on the speed of that, you can change the modulation that actually comes out of there. So that's one kind of delivery technique that's called sliding window or dynamic intensity modulated radiation therapy. Another way is just to take this kind of shape that you want and break it up into a lot of little pixels and deliver different intensities to each of those different pixels, and that's called step and shoot. Okay, so let's go here. Okay, so this is what it used to look like. So this is kind of high-precision radiotherapy of the prostate, and so this is kind of where they started. So this is showing a four-field box. You come in with four different fields from all different cardinal angles, and where all those things superimpose in the center, you get a high dose, and where you only have one beam traveling in or an exit beam from the other side, you have lower dose. And so the limitation was is that you're kind of way over covering the target and you're going to start causing toxicities in the normal structures around there. So one simple way to overcome that is to do conformal radiotherapy. And so this is showing coming in from multiple beam angles now, not just four, and we're conforming to the target. And so now you can see here this blue isodose is actually kind of showing the prescription region covering the target and minimizing the dose to the rectum and the femoral heads. Now, to take it to the next step, you can actually do IMRT. And so here, we're bringing in not only a larger number of beams, but we're also modulating the intensity of each of those beams as they come in. So this allows us to kind of exquisitely shape this red contour, which is the high dose region, around the target that we're trying to treat. Okay, so that's IMRT. This is showing for a particular case for a stereotactic lung radiotherapy. This is an RTOG trial that we entered at Princess Margaret. So here's a patient with an inoperable lung tumor here. You can see the lung tumor and its little spicules of vasculature kind of adhering to the chest wall. And so this was a patient that had no other option before because they're medically inoperable. We can actually treat them with high-intensity modulated radiation therapy. And so here's showing all the kind of different beam angles and a dose that's coming in. So, of course, it's not just about delivering dose. We also want to know where we're delivering it to. So we want to have a nice conformal dose, but we also want to be able to see where it's going. And so this is the technology that was kind of pioneered at Princess Margaret Hospital. So this is a gantry-mounted kilovoltage X-ray tube, an amorphous silicon flat panel detector. This rotates about the patient, capturing a series of 2D projection images. We can reconstruct those images, and then while the patient is in the treatment position, ready to go, we actually have a 3D volumetric image of the patient anatomy. And so we're going to use this in order to localize the target that we're trying to treat and kind of minimize the uncertainties associated with treatment. So, of course, this is not a new idea. This is from 1959. This was a device that was developed at PMH and OCI. This was by Harold Johns and Jack Cunningham. So what they had is a cobalt source, and so this is, rather than the 201 sources of the gamma knife, this is only one cobalt source that slides in and out, and there's actually an X-ray tube mounted in the top of this. Now, the limitation that they had, so this is actually called the Exotron. So this is a picture of the Exotron looking very kind of futuristic in the 1950s. So one of the limitations they had was, well, they didn't have really good ways of detecting these X-rays and forming the images. And so kind of what's kind of fueled this revolution is the development of amorphous silicon flat panel detectors. And basically, every type of LINAC that you buy now has some form of image guidance on it. I think more than 80% of LINACs sold have some form of image-guided imaging devices. Okay, so, well, what's pioneering this? We call this the IGRT explosion, so we're getting lots and lots of data. So what's pioneering is the amorphous silicon flat panel detectors. So these are very, very large area detectors. This is 41 centimeters by 41 centimeters. Has a series of 1,024 by 1,024 pixels on here. Now, the problem with X-rays, unlike a camera, is that you can't focus them. They basically start at a point and diverge until they run into something. And so if you want to take an image of them, you have to have a very, very large image, unlike a digital camera where you can focus them down with lensing, down to a CCD, and have very large spatial resolution. And so this kind of amorphous silicon flat panel detectors, the way that they work, well, what they have, they were pioneered at by Bob Street at Xerox PARC in the 80s using thin film electronics, which is basically a switch, and this is a photodiode which detects light. And so having a number of these kind of on this kind of large sheet of glass, you can actually detect the X-rays and measure out an image. And so the way they do that is they take this kind of array, they have to bring in a bias line to power the photodiode, then you bring in a gate line which kind of switches on this pixel in order to read it out. And when you want to read it out, the data will stream out this data line and be read by, sent through an amplifier and then sent to an analog to digital converter to turn it into a digital number rather than an analog number. And of course, we have a bunch of these on an array. So typically, the pixels that we use on our panels are anywhere from, say, 400 microns to 194 microns in size. And so quite small and lots of them in a plane. And these panels are quite expensive, typically 100K plus. So if you took one of your panels and cut it in half, but you shouldn't do that, and flipped it over to the side, this is what it kind of looks like in a profile view. So what you have on the top of it is a scintillating material. So this is a material, usually has some kind of high atomic number of materials in it. What it does is basically a photon or an X-ray catcher. It's going to take that photon and turn it into visible light. So as that photon comes in, it interacts, you get kind of light. That light impinges onto the imaging matrix, and then it's read out. And so that's what it shows in these next couple of slides there. It kind of blurs down We have the BIOS, which is reading out those photodiodes. It's reading them into analog to digital converter and then forming a digital emitter. And not every single photon is going to interact. The trade-off is that the larger I make the scintillator, the better efficiency I'm going to catch, and I'm going to catch more photons. But the problem is that when a photon is caught in here, it tends to blur as the light kind of propagates along. And so if I have a very, very thick phosphor on here, I'm going to get a very, very blur image. And so it's a trade-off between efficiency and spatial resolution. So this is what it looks like in terms of the raw projection data. So this is one of our head and neck patients. It's just showing the 1024 by 1024 pixel array. So that you can see the patient's kind of breathing here and swallowing every once in a while. And you can see right away that there's actually kind of dead pixels on the panel. We have anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 dead pixels of the million pixels on here. And so we have to be able to characterize where these pixels are and be able to correct for them. The other thing is that the imaging is not perfect. Each pixel has a slightly different response to X-rays than other pixels. So what we typically do is capture a dark field. This is the image with no radiation coming onto the panel, so it has a very interesting structure to do with how they deposit the layers when they actually form these things. And then you have a flood field image, which is the response of the pixels to a known amount of radiation. So here you can see kind of has this blocky type behavior because some analog amplifiers have a little different gain than other ones. And so once we take those images, we can actually apply them through a gain and offset correction. We normalize the exposure and fix the bad pixels. And now we have this kind of cleaned up image. And so this is showing the cleaned up image. Now we don't have any bad pixels anymore. And one of the things that we've done is apertured and resampled this to kind of reduce the amount of data we have. We don't need 1024 by 1024 data. We want to have a little bit smaller, so we've downsampled it 4x4. And so now the next thing we're going to do is we're going to take this and we're going to run it through a filtered back projection. So this is based on the Feldkamp algorithms developed by Feldkamp, who used to work at Henry Ford, sorry, the Ford Motor Company. He developed this technology for imaging engine blocks. And so what you basically do is you find, you take your image, you take the log, and you weight the image. You filter the image to kind of sharpen it up and enhance the edges, and then you basically do a back projection. So you follow each pixel, and you chase it through your volumetric image, and you trace it one by one by one by one. Now, the nice thing about this is it's a perfectly parallelizable process. The more processors that you have to throw at this, the faster it will go. And as you start getting those projections in, you can start reconstructing them. So typically, the reconstructed images are done by the time we finish rotating. And so this is showing after we've kind of cleaned up this image and log filtered it. So now what you might notice is that the bones are white now rather than being black, because I'm showing you attenuation rather than transmission. So where the air is here, there's no attenuation. And then the next step I'm going to do is I'm going to filter this, which is going to enhance the edges in order for the back projection process. And so that's this process here. And so basically what you do is you slide a ramp filter around here, which is like a derivative filter, and now you have these kind of really enhancing the kind of edges of these things. And so here you can see the mask. This patient would have a mask on to immobilize them, and you can see the table and the frame and all the things that kind of disappeared before. And now I'm going to fire this into my back projection algorithm, which is simply a big set of linear equations. So here's what the equation looks like. You're solving for the attenuation coefficient, and these are your projections on the other side. And you can see as we back project, we kind of form this image, and the image kind of lifts out of the sand. And now we have this three-dimensional volumetric image, and this is what we're going to use in order to target the patient position. So the nice thing about this, it's taken in the treatment position. So that's what we look like if we kind of volumetrically rendered here. So here you can see exquisitely the detail of the skull and the cervical vertebrae and muscle and fat and different layers on the kind of neck. And so this is now what we can use in the treatment position in order to target this patient. Okay, so we've kind of designed this into an entire system. So we acquire this image. We take the projections, we reconstruct them, we fire that over to an online targeting system or a treatment system, and we can see what we plan or where we plan to put the dose, and we can see where the patient is today. And based on the mismatch between those two things, we can decide to intervene. So one typical intervention is that we would just adjust the position of the patient. And so we would adjust the position of the patient and then continue on with the treatment. Okay, so one of the ways we adjust the patient position, so this is showing in a kind of a schematic of the LINAC, is that the patient is typically laying on this treatment couch. This treatment couch has a three-axis motion control system inside, so you can actually adjust the patient of position very precisely, up, down, left, right, and in, out. And so what we typically do is fire it into a targeting system. Now, I just apologize, I have to flip over to here. Okay, so now I'm going to play this. And so this is showing you kind of this is a live kind of screen scraping of the kind of targeting. And so I'm just going to push play on here. So what we're seeing, and let me hit Alt-Enter, Control-Enter, to go full screen. Is that playing? Let's go play. There we go. Okay, so what we can see here is we're showing two images on top of each other. And the way we do that is we actually show purple is showing the CT scan and green is showing the online image. And when you have a mismatch, you can see purple and green. Well, if you add purple and green together, you actually get white. And so the more white or the more gray I have, the better I'm doing. And so what I'm doing here is just kind of a manual correction of actually adjusting that patient position. So now we can see that the tumor outlined in red is actually a fairly good coverage of that. And this would calculate the three-axis translation as well as the rotation in order to match that up. And so this translation is what we would actually take to the LINAC, make the adjustment of the patient position, and then continue on with treatment. And so one way to do that is manually, but of course we can also do this, we can do this automatically. So let me go Alt-Enter. There we go. And so this is showing automatic matching. So what I'm doing here, you can see this kind of dashed line here is outlining what we call a clip box. And so what it does is it basically takes all the voxels that are inside this clip box, and this is a three-dimensional representation of that clip box, and it fires them into an automatic cross-correlation algorithm. And so what it tries to do is it tries to maximize the cross-correlation of these voxels from the reference image to the online image, and where those are an optimum, it says that's where the patient should be treated today. And so here it's just going for approval and then fires out. So that's what it shows like. So that's the original image there. So just to kind of orient yourself, this is kind of a coronal slice through the patient. This is an axial slice through the patient. This is a sagittal slice through the patient. So it's kind of tricky when you're doing 3D matching is that all things move at once. If you make an adjustment here, it's going to affect the other windows. David. Absolutely, yes. Probably a radiation oncologist would have done the target outline, and then the clip box would be defined the first day of treatment when the patient starts. You say, okay, this is what I want to target. You might want to target a bigger volume. You might want to match up bone. You might want to match up bladder. Or you might want to use some other type of target. But this one is actually targeting the prostate and the fiducial markers, which are actually implanted inside the prostate. And so that's the optimization problem associated with that. Okay, let me flip back to here. Okay, so I just got to skip those slides. There we go. Okay, so this is some data from the initial targeting studies we did. We took the first month of data when we had this new system commissioned, and we looked at all the patients that kind of came through there. We took an image of them before their treatment, we shifted them, and then we took an image after the treatment to see where the residual error was. And so we got quite amazing results. This is the breakdown of patients that we had. There were 34 patients, 135 scans altogether. Most of them were lung patients, some head and neck, lymphomas, sarcomas, and an upper GI patient, some upper GI patients. And so what I'm looking at here is kind of error histogram. So what I'm plotting here is the translation error and the rotational error. And this is showing it in the ant post direction, so front and back. This is showing it in the soup to inf, so feet to head, and then left-right position. And so what you can see here in these kind of error distributions that the standard deviation, this is on the order of millimeters, so plus or minus 5 millimeters on this scale. And so what you can actually see is that the standard deviation is about 1 millimeter. So that's 1.05, 1.01, and 0.82, which is quite amazing because a dime is 1.2 millimeters. So on 135 scans of 34 patients, we can actually precisely target their anatomy to within the thickness of a dime 67% of the time. So one of the other things that we actually measure too is the fact that the patient could be rotated as well. And so this is something we quantify. So So the rotations are in the order of 1.3 degrees, 1.3 degrees, 1.3 degrees. And so that's something that we can't really account for. Because we're translating the patient position, is that rotations are something that can confound your ability to target. So you hope, by the way that you've set up the patient and the mobilization device and the clinical processes that you have, that these rotations are going to be very small. And they seem to be very small on patients. Okay, so space and time. So this is a space and time plot. So what I'm plotting here is space on the vertical axis, and I'm plotting time on the horizontal axis, and I've kind of thrown in kind of different things that we're used to. So human life is about 2 billion seconds. Apparently, if you take our our average life expectancy and divide by our average heart rate, you get about 3 billion. So we're good for about 3 billion heartbeats. Most other mammals are only good for a billion, so we're actually beating the Grim Reaper by 2 billion heartbeats. A cancer treatment is typically on the order of 4 to 8 weeks. Your lungs kind of go at, you know, 5 to 10 seconds. Your heart beats probably about every second. A cone beam CT is typically takes about 100 seconds or 2 minutes to acquire and is on the order of 1 millimeter spatial resolution. So this kind of dashed box that I kind of outlined here is pretty much our limits of detectability in terms of in vivo detection or monitoring of cancer. We can't really see things that are kind of smaller than a centimeter in terms of detection, and we can't really see things that are kind of faster than a second. And so this is kind of the frontier of imaging research, is that we're continually trying to make our imaging faster. The holy grail, of course, is to image the beating heart so you can actually see the plaques and see the interventions that you're working on. You want to be able to see things that are smaller than a centimeter or a millimeter. So, for instance, the cell here is on the order of about 10 microns. So it'd be really nice to be able to see a cell and diagnose it kind of in vivo. And so these are kind of the challenges that we're kind of pushing towards. So I want to give you one example of where we're pushing time this way and one example where we're pushing space this way, pushing against the boundaries of space and time. Okay, so this is one where we push against time. And so this is a very expensive four-dimensional CT phantom. So this is our crocodile clock. And so what you're seeing here is 10 seconds at 30 frames per second of a digital video image of this clock. And so you can see here this thing's moving back and forth. Now, I did a reconstruction on this image. And so what I basically did is I took those 300 frames that I had and I just summed them together. And so what you'll notice is that things that are crisp, things that didn't move, are actually looking quite crisp in the image, but things that were moving are looking kind of blurry. And so this is kind of what we see when we take images of the heart or when we take images of the lungs. We see things that kind of are moving in front of our camera and they just blur out. And so what I want to do is I want to try and capture that information and hopefully dig back in time to actually reconstruct that. And so what we do is we make an image-based aperture. So what I did is, that one's not running. So what I did is I stick a little aperture on here, and you actually see the hand kind of wheel in and out of this aperture. So as it's wheeling in and out, what I did is I simply calculated the mean green value on that aperture. So I calculate the average green intensity of that. And so surprisingly, if I look at that, you actually get this kind of beautiful kind of periodic signal. And one of the nasty things I did is I turned off the camera at 5 seconds and waited a bit and then turned it back on. So I had a periodic event, and then I had an aperiodic event. So those two things kind of happen all the time. So I can take that periodic signal, and I can throw it into a phase plot here. And so here you can see this kind of a phase as I go around in phase angle. I look at amplitude of those things. And so now I want to take advantage of the reproducibility of that event to try and look at that image. And so as this thing's swinging back and forth, I want to look at it at one particular phase in the motion. And so what I can do is I can bin that. So here's my time trace and my phase plot. So I can either do amplitude binning, or I could do picking projections or images that were at a particular amplitude, which corresponds to an annulus on the phase plot, or I could do phase binning, looking at kind of a pie wedge out of the phase plot or a particular point. And those are going to cause kind of different behaviors. And so this is exactly what the commercial system that's available right now called the Varian RPM system. What it basically has is a block which has two reflective markers on it. And so it looks at this block. What's looking at this block is an infrared emitter and then a CCD camera, which sees that reflected infrared light. And it knows exactly how far apart those two blocks are. And so based on that, you can actually see this kind of time trace. And so this is showing, as a function of time, showing the position of that block on the patient's chest. So now I have some phasing information that I can try to capture. I feed the patient into the CT scanner, taking slice-based images. And so as the patient's going in, I can see exactly what phase that image was captured at, and I can separate those into different bins and show them separately. So now it allows me to show these kind of exquisite four-dimensional CT images. So this is showing a volumetric rendering of a lung cancer patient. So you can see where the lung cancer is up on the kind of two lobes of the lung here joining onto the chest wall. And so it's showing the lungs kind of beating up and down. You can actually see an outline of the block on the stomach here, so that's actually what's used for the phasing information. So I can take this, all those different phases, those slices, and put them together. And so the premise is that the patient was breathing the same when the CT scanner was looking here as it was looking down here. And that's not a bad premise if the patient is breathing regularly. Sometimes you see a little bit of artifact here on the diaphragm. You might see a little bit of chunkiness where the phasing information wasn't exact. And so this is something that we can do right now, and we do this for all our thoracic patients, to be able to quantify the motion and use that motion for targeting. So, well, we can do the same thing on the linear accelerator. Let me kick this one off. See if that one works. Oh, rats, that one doesn't work. So the linear accelerator here, this kind of stats for that particular image capture, it takes about 2 minutes for rotation. We capture at 5.5 frames a second. It's a very, very quick X-ray exposure. And so if I show you what that image looks like, that's just showing what the acquisition geometry looks like. So here's what an imaging sequence looks like for one of our liver cancer patients. So here you can see as we're rotating around this patient, you can see that this, you know, the heart is beating away and fluttering. You can see the diaphragm moving up and down. Pretty much the ribs are fairly stationary. You can see the couch support kind of wheeling it out. So we can see in this dimension here we have consistent information all at one time. So we've kind of captured that snapshot in time. So maybe we can use that information in order to do our phasing and phase reconstruction. And so how do we do that? Well, we put it into something called a 3D sinogram. So this is showing the exact same data as before. So I'm plotting the kind of two dimensions in space versus this kind of dimension in gantry angle or phase or time. And this information is what I'm going to use. And I know from my geometric calibration and my kind of setup of the LINAC, I know precisely how points in projection space correspond to real points in the world. And so I can take advantage of that information. And so what I do here is if I flip it over like this, this is kind of what you'd see in, if you've ever done 2D kind of CT imaging, you can see a 2D sinogram. So this is showing the axis of rotation here. You can see the skin line of the patient. The reason they call it a sinogram is that because single points in space kind of trace a sinusoidal path as we go around. So here you can see that something is amiss. As the diaphragm has kind of come in and out of this imaging plane, you can see this kind of speed bump type behavior. So you know that something's not consistent. Well, you can definitely see that if you flip it around the other way. So let's flip it around the other way. Now we can see here, this is basically our respiration signal. And so this is burned into those images. So it's just our job to kind of run through this set of images, capture that respiration signal, and use that for phasing reconstruction. So we can do that. Here's our image-based aperture. So you can make a tall and skinny aperture or a short and fat aperture. It turns out it's better to make a short and fat aperture. And I drill through this data set capturing some kind of metric on that aperture. Easy metric is just seeing what the average attenuation is on that aperture. So as the diaphragm rolls in, we see the attenuation go up. As the diaphragm rolls down, you see the attenuation go down. We can capture that and use that for phasing information. So this is showing a different patient here. So this is a lung cancer patient. So here's the aperture in green showing the projection of that. You can see this kind of diaphragm going up and down, and you can see the up and down phase. And you can actually see the outline of the tumor here. This is the planning target volume and the actual tumor volume here outlined in cyan. And so it's this information that we're really interested in, but this is a surrogate of our information, and we're going to use this surrogate in order to break that projections into different bins and reconstruct them separately. Okay, so this is, if we've taken those and all reconstruct them, so this is showing a coronal slice here. You can see that the red X is where our isocenter is and where we're trying to target, and we can actually see the kind of tumor moving up and down. So on the treatment unit, we can quantify the motion and see if that motion compares to what we've planned for at the time of treatment planning. Well, we can also do this on a daily basis. So this is an interesting work from our collaborators at the Netherlands Cancer Institute, Jan-Jakob Sonke. So here you can see kind of over a multiple time periods, you're looking at three dimensions in space and a sagittal slice through the tumor. The tumor is outlined in red, or that's what we plan to treat. And you can see here that as the treatment progresses, the tumor is actually responding. You can see it changing size. Here it's getting a little bit smaller. Maybe it's changing its attachment. It doesn't seem to be attached the diaphragm, and it's actually the phasing information, the phasing of the tumor motion with respect to the breathing is actually changing. And so you can see this kind of behavior all the way through treatment. So they call this their five-dimensional viewer. It's three dimensions in space, one dimension in phase, and another dimension in the longitudinal time of looking at these things over treatment. So this is kind of very, very interesting data that we're kind of just figuring out how to use and respond to. One of the other things we'll notice too is this is just taking a simple set for a post-prostatectomy patient. What I'm doing is looking at coronal slices on different days, and so I'm just kind of panning through those two things so you can see the fraction. This is day one, day two, day three, day four. So what you'll notice is that the kind of bones, the leg position here is slightly different. It's kind of shifting around. You can definitely see the bladder is really, really full that day and really less that day. And so this is the kind of information that we're able to see every day. We didn't know this before when we weren't doing soft tissue imaging on the linear accelerator. All we could see was bones, and we'd say, yup, the bones are bang on. Now we can see kind of gas and bladder and things changing around. So how are we going to respond to this information? So this is some work from Mike Sharp, who's sitting in the audience right now. So this is looking at head and neck cancer patients over a seven-week period. So what we notice is that as the treatment is progressing, their tumor or some of their normal tissues can actually shrink. And so when they shrink, they actually pull things into the high-dose region or pull things out of the high-dose region. So that's a bad thing. And so that's something that we can measure, and we're trying to figure out how do we respond to those. So here's looking at a lymphoma patient. So this is a PET CT, so this is where they give a radioactive tracer, and it's usually associated with glucose, and the glucose kind of picks up in areas where you have active metabolism. So this is showing nice big kind of lymphoma on the first day. And so as the treatment is progressing here, you can see that PET signal actually diminishes quite rapidly. And so that's kind of good, and you can actually see that. What happens if it doesn't respond rapidly? What are you going to do, and how are you going to respond to that information? And so that kind of led us think about kind of opening up these kind of questions and having a way of exploring these questions. So this has led to the development of a facility called the Spatial Temporal Targeting and Amplification of Radiation Response, called STAR. So two T's, two R's. So the vision is to control cancer without toxicity, and the idea is that it's going to create a kind of platform to do preclinical studies. So we're going to look at tumor and responses in small animals, mice, rats, and rabbits. And so the idea here is that we can look at them in a molecular level, a cellular level, or even a physiological level, and measure that on a day-to-day basis as they get radiation treatment. So this is kind of a huge overview of the kind of clinical space. We have lots of different modalities of images that we can take. We can look at those modality images. We use that to populate a patient model. So now we can see a CT scan, a CT PET, which is showing some function and some cancer cells. We can see an MR, which is going to give us exquisite soft tissue detail. We're going to kind of lump all those things together. We're going to calculate a treatment plan. We're going to deliver that treatment plan, and we're going to use image guidance to actually make the adjustments on a day-to-day basis and monitor how the treatment's going. So this is kind of what we're kind of striving for in the clinic, but we want to be able to open up other questions, like, for instance, what's the optimal fractionation schedule? What's the optimal dose in order to give these targets? What's the optimal radiosensitizer or response variable to look at? So these are the folks kind of behind the Canadian Foundation for Innovation grant. So it's Rob Bristow, Michael Osovich, and David Jaffrey. It's broken into four cores. One is for cellular imaging, animal imaging, human imaging, as well as image analysis and registration. And so I'm involved with a little bit with two and a little bit with four. And so this is kind of where it looks like. It's just down the street, down College Street, just down from here. It's the seventh floor of the Toronto Medical Discovery Tower, which is part of the MARS complex, Medical and Related Sciences. So here's the floor plan here. We have a 21,000-foot square foot animal care facility, which is one floor below. Then we have a bunch of dedicated rooms here to look at various imaging modalities and treatment modalities, as well as some lab and cellular space, as well as staff and computer space. So these are the modalities that we're going to chase: micro-CT, micro-SPECT, micro-PET, micro-MR, looking at longitudinal imaging of these animals under treatment, also micro-ultrasound and micro-optical. And the data that flows off here, well, it all comes off in DICOM format, And so we're pretty confident that we know how to store glycon images. This is a solved problem that has been going on for medical imaging for a long time. So this is a picture archiving communication system, or PAC system, from one of our partners, Sidera Software, which is located in Mississauga. So this data all kind of gets crunched onto a server, which has a nice relational database underneath. And so basically the scanners kind of push the data out, and then we have viewers which can view this data off. And so that's we're quite confident about that part. It's this part that we really don't know how to handle, because a lot of a principal investigator has an animal use protocol. That animal use protocol has multiple animals in multiple cages. Now, these animals have multiple measurements that are done. They might get measured for weight or other types of markers. There's lots of notes and observations and, of course, imaging. And so this is the data flow that we're kind of struggling with right now and how to keep this. And the animal facility is going to store about 12,000 mice in those cages. So you can imagine that the data is going to add up very quickly. So data is that we suspect a data storm is imminent. That's my joke slide. Okay, so well, we're kind of seeing this in the clinic right now. This is the image-guided infrastructure at Princess Margaret. We have 10 of our 16 linear accelerators are equipped to image with cone beam CT using a kilovoltage imaging and flat panel detectors. So this is data from last year. So this is all the months, or sorry, all the weeks from last year, showing the number of volumetric images that we took per week. And so you can see here, we kind of installed our first LINAC at the beginning of 2006. And then we kind of marched along, and we peaked just before Christmas. We were taking 450 volumetric images a week on different patients. And so that came to a total of about 600 patients, which is only about 10% of our patients, giving about 10,000 volumetric images that we had. And so this was corresponding to about 4 terabytes of data. And this curve is still growing. So we're starting to buy disks and buy disk stocks. So this is the kind of storage technology or storage solution that we've kind of bought into, is that we like these kind of IP SAN, so this is storage area network over internet protocol. So these are kind of racks of disks that use kind of low cost, they actually use SATA drives, so lower cost drives than a SCSI drive, and very expandable and very scalable. So you just keep putting more disks into this as the disk starts filling up. So this is one of the platforms that I'm involved in. So this is a what's called a conventional simulator. So this is how radiation therapy used to be planned. This has an X-ray tube in the top. The patient would lie here, and then a series of projections would be taken in order to calculate or see where the bones are in order to define the targets. We've taken this and modified this to have a flat panel detector on it. It rotates around to take a volumetric image. And then as you'll notice here, there's an orange and kind of a pink thing. That's a high-energy X-ray tube, an orthovoltage X-ray tube used for industrial inspection of welds and pipes. And we've mounted that on there. And once we're done with the image, we can actually translate that arm back and actually treat the small animals. So this is kind of a mini linear accelerator for treating mice and rats. So this is some in vivo images that we just got last 2 weeks ago. This is off our micro CT. So this is showing a volumetric rendering of a mouse. And a mouse is, you know, not very big. It's only about, you know, 5 centimeters. So it's quite amazing the kind of detail that you can actually see, all the vertebral bodies, the kind of plates in the skull. You can actually see that throughout their intestinal tract, typically they're given animal feed which has ground up bone in it, has bone meal. And so you can see all those kind of little bits of bone kind of accumulating in their intestinal tract. So one of the other things that we have is a conformal microscope. So this is a kind of a quick overview of the slide that I showed before. So this is kind of human fibroblast cells where you can actually stain to see the nucleus of the cell, and then stain to see the actual DNA damage or the double strand breaks. So typically a cell is kind of most susceptible in the mitotic stage of that. And so this is actually a 3D volumetric image. And so we can actually render that 3D volumetric image. So that's what it looks like. So here it's showing the kind of nuclei here. And this is 125 microns by 125 microns by about 50 microns thick. And so you can see all these kind of green spots are where that DNA happened within that kind of a nucleus, which is in light brown. So this is something that we're trying to figure out how to process these. We want to be able to quantify where each of those cell nuclei are, and we want to be able to quantify how many double strand breaks with respect to the 3D volumetric image. So this is kind of way cool data that's kind of way out there right now. Okay, so that brings me to my summary. So radiation therapy, it's been around for a long time. It's a proven local therapy. The future allows us to better characterize our targets in order to target these delivery and also have better delivery with IMRT and radiation therapy. And of course, the challenging data issues in oncology always are we have lots of multimodal images. We have longitudinal imaging, so multiple images on the same patient, and long-term follow-up. Once a patient is treated, we follow them 6 months, a year, 10 years, 5 years, all the way down. And so that's it, I think. And I just acknowledge a very talented clinical staff, as well as some of our collaborators, industrial partners, and collaborators around the world. And that is it. Thank you very much for your attention.